Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Ukrainian forces battle pro-Russian militia in Slovyansk, and Boko Haram claims responsibility for schoolgirls' kidnapping. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington. Ukrainian government forces fought gun battles Monday with pro-Russia militia in the separatist-controlled eastern Ukrainian city of Slovyansk. Russia's Interfax news agency quoted a separatist source in Slovyansk as saying possibly more than 20 pro-Russian militants had been killed in the fighting. Ukraine's Interior Ministry reported 4 paramilitary police had died in the battle. The Defense Ministry reported a Ukrainian Armed Forces M124 helicopter was shot down over Slovyansk, but the pilots survived. Local media reports Ukrainian forces recaptured a television tower outside of Slovyansk. A Russian Foreign Ministry statement called for Ukraine's government to end the bloodshed, withdraw the troops, and sit down at the negotiating table to start a normal dialogue on ways to resolve the political crisis. The Islamist militant sect Boko Haram has claimed responsibility for last month's kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls in northern Nigeria. The claim came in a Hausa language video released to news agencies Monday. Gunmen abducted the schools from a school in the town of Chibok, Borneo State, on April 14th. Nigerian authorities say some escaped, but 276 are still missing. On Sunday, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan ordered top security officials to do everything possible to secure the girls' release.
We promise that wherever these girls are, we'll surely get them out. One good thing that I'm a bit happy, and I believe most Nigerians are happy, is that there's no story that any of them has been hurt or injured.
The president described it as a trying and painful time and pleaded for the cooperation of parents, guardians, and local communities in the rescue efforts. South Sudan's army battled rebels in the oil town of Bentiu Monday, damaging hopes of new peace talks to end a nearly five-month civil war. Army spokesman Philip Aguirre said there was heavy fighting Monday in the northern town, but that government troops had the upper hand. Bentiu fell into rebel hands last month. The United Nations has accused the rebels of killing hundreds of people in the town based on their nationality or ethnic origin. The rebels have denied carrying out the killings. Greek officials say two boats crammed with migrants have capsized off the island of Samos, drowning 2 people. Coast Guard says it has rescued 36 people, but 30 are missing after the early Monday morning accident in the waters where hundreds of other migrants have died this year. Authorities say they do not yet know the nationalities of the migrants. Greece, Italy, and Malta have repeatedly asked their EU partners to do more to help them handle the large number of migrants. Rescuers off the coast of Hong Kong are searching for 11 crew members of a Chinese cargo ship that sank after colliding with a container vessel. Hong Kong officials say a fishing boat rescued one man after the two ships collided before dawn Monday, several kilometers south of the southern Chinese city. Local officials are coordinating rescue efforts with mainland China. Officials say the 97-meter cargo vessel registered in mainland China sank after colliding with the 300-meter container vessel. The U.S. and Philippine militaries have launched a large 10-day annual military exercise amid increasing tensions in the disputed South China Sea. Officials said at the opening ceremony Monday that this year's drills, known as Shoulder to Shoulder, will focus on maritime security. Panama's vice president has won a surprise victory in the presidential election. Juan Carlos Varela, who had distanced himself politically from President Ricardo Martinelli, has been declared the winner of Sunday's vote. Election day began with opinion polls pointing to a tight race among the top 3 candidates. And Thailand's King Bhumibol Adulyadej has made a rare public appearance to attend a ceremony marking the anniversary of his coronation 64 years ago. The 86-year-old Reverend King is the world's longest reigning monarch, ascending the throne on May 5, 1950. That's the news from the Voice of America. I'm Bob Doty reporting.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiye Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders is reducing its operations in Central African Republic for 1 week. The move is to protest the recent killings of 16 civilians, including three staffers at a northern hospital.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details coming up.
Also, South Sudan's army battled rebels in the town of Bentiu today, damaging hopes of a new peace talks. And the Islamist militant sect Boko Haram claims responsibility for last month's kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls in northern Nigeria.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Islamist militant sect Boko Haram claims responsibility for last month's kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls in northern Nigeria. In a video sent to news agencies today, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau says, "I abducted your girls," and also vows to sell them in the marketplace. Gunmen abducted the girls from a school in the town of Chibok, Borno State, on April 14th. Nigerian authorities say some escaped, but 276 are still missing. Yesterday, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan ordered top security officials to do everything possible to secure the girls' release. The president described it as a trying and painful time and pleaded for the cooperation of parents, guardians, and local communities in the rescue efforts. Unconfirmed reports say some of the girls have been married to their captors, while others allegedly have been moved across the border into Cameroon and Chad.
Gunmen who crossed the border from Nigeria into North Cameroon today killed two people, including a soldier, and freed suspected militants from an army post. Authorities believe that assailants are members of the radical Islamic sect Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
30 armed men entered Cameroon's territory from Nigeria's Borno State early Monday and attacked a military post in the town of Kuseri. Parts of the town, which also borders Chad, were ransacked in the attack. Cameroon's state radio reports that a soldier and a prisoner were killed and an undisclosed number of Boko Haram members freed. State radio journalist Ebenezer Akanga, who is based in the area, told VOA in a telephone interview that the invaders opened fire indiscriminately.
As soon as they got to the brigade, they opened fire. One of the gendarmes on guard reposted in an attempt to push back the assailants. The members freed one of theirs, who was being held under custody after he was arrested last Saturday in Kuseri with arms.
Akanga said the attackers left with a huge consignment of arms and ammunition. He says defense forces have tightened security along the borders. It was the third time Boko Haram attacked the Cameroonian city, and each time they have killed Cameroonian soldiers. Suspected Boko Haram members have been operating in the area. They are believed to have kidnapped 11 foreign workers, including four clergy. On Monday, Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the kidnapping last month of more than 200 girls from a school in Nigeria's Borno State. News reports have suggested some of the girls may have been brought across the border into Cameroon. Critics of Cameroon's government have accused it of not doing enough to fight Boko Haram. I posed that question to government spokesperson Issa Chiruma.
We all know the saying that when the neighbor's house is consumed by fire, there is a risk that we receive sparks. Cameroon is resolutely committed, in collaboration with its neighboring countries, in the fight against terrorism and border crime.
Following Monday's attack, the suspected Boko Haram members went back to Nigeria with a man police sources described as one of the group's leaders. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Ten minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has warned of sanctions and other possible consequences if South Sudan's government and rebel forces do not commit to talks aimed at ending nearly 5 months of civil war. Kerry spoke in the Angolan capital of Luanda today on the final leg of his African tour. He secured a commitment to talks from South Sudanese President Salva Kiir last week. Kerry said rebel leader Riek Machar has a fundamental decision to make in the way he proceeds. He says there will be accountability and implications for those who block these efforts. VOA reporter Scott Stearns, who was traveling with Kerry, says Machar, who initially seemed open to the talks in a telephone call with the Secretary of State, is now backtracking. Also, the South Sudanese army battled Machar's rebels in the key oil town of Bentiu today. The town fell into rebel hands last month.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders is reducing its operations in Central Africa Republic for 1 week. The move is to protest the recent killings of 16 civilians, including three staffers at a northern hospital. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The civilians were killed on April 26th during an armed robbery of the hospital in Bogila. The group, also known by its French acronym MSF, has since evacuated its remaining personnel from the area. Stefano Argenziano is MSF head of mission in CAR.
This has been an act of extreme violence onto MSF and onto the local population. And a week later, we have decided to temporarily reduce throughout the country in about 15 locations all our medical activities to only life-saving services.
Since December 2012, MSF has been the victim of 115 security incidents, including 31 armed robberies. It has repeatedly complained about the insecurity, including the attack in Bogila, which it describes as the most extreme and tragic of the past year.
Following the massacre in Bogila, there's been no official reaction nor condemnation from the government of Central African Republic, nor from the different armed groups operating in CAR, in the Central African Republic, and we find this unacceptable.
Argenziano says there was no mistaking the 115-bed hospital for anything but a medical facility.
The hospital is clearly identified as MSF facility, and so were the staff which got killed during the attack. One of the most outrageous elements of the tragedy is the total lack of respect for a medical facility, for a hospital, the place where not only they could receive medical care, but also receive a certain degree of protection.
The MSF head of mission says it's not clear when the hospital in Bogila might reopen. The group is negotiating with all parties involved in the CAR violence about ensuring the safety of its personnel. Following those talks, a decision will be made on whether to restore all of its medical programs in the country to full operation. Doctors Without Borders is calling on the international community to do more to protect the civilian population. The group has been working in the country since 1997, with more than 300 international staff members and more than 2,000 CAR national employees. Violence in CAR grew dramatically worse last December. That's when Christian militias, known as anti-Balaka, formed and launched revenge attacks against the mostly Muslim Seleka rebels. Since then, most of the Muslim population in Bangui has been relocated to safer locations. Civilians are the prime targets for both groups. The transitional government has not been able to stem the killings. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
On May 7th, South Africans go to the polls to elect new national and provincial legislatures. The winning party will then name the president and provincial premiers. Many analysts expect the African National Congress to maintain an overwhelming but slightly reduced majority and renew the mandate of President Jacob Zuma. They also expect the main opposition, the Democratic Alliance, to make gains because of accusations of corruption within the ANC and continuing complaints of high unemployment and slow delivery of services. From Washington, William Eagle reports.
For months, opinion polls had shown lagging public confidence in the ANC. The drop is blamed in part on the expenditure of millions of tax dollars in lavish improvements of the presidential complex at Nkandla. Public opinion also reflected disapproval of the violent police response to striking miners in Marikana 2 years ago. But a recent poll by the research company Ipsos showed that 65% of voters still intend to vote for the ANC, at least on the national level. Yaki Siliers is the director of the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria. He says South Africans still vote on party loyalty rather than policy. Many black South Africans reward the ANC for ending white rule 20 years ago. And he says while many urban supporters are critical of corruption scandals, rural voters overwhelmingly credit the party for improving their lives.
You must remember the ANC is more than 100 years old. It's got an unparalleled brand. And there are two stories about South Africa. The one story is, the story of Nkandla, corruption, and so on. The other story is really, if you look quite carefully at what the ANC has been able to deliver, it has been access to electricity, social grants, infrastructure in rural areas. These things are not that visible to many South Africans. But I've just spent the last 2 days driving from East London in the Eastern Cape through to Durban. And you can see the extent of impact that the ANC has made in rural areas.
Others attribute the successful patronage systems built by parties with origins as liberation movements. Hussein Solomon is a professor of political studies at the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein, South Africa.
It took the Congress Party in India almost 50 years to lose elections. Them, of course, saying that we delivered you from the British Raj, we delivered you from the British Raj, okay? What I'm saying to you is that there's still a loyalty to the ANC. At the same time, the ANC has been very smart, conflating state and party, government and party, in that they've been handing out food parcels, putting up buildings, and so on, and claiming this is the ANC government is doing this way, putting up concerts for the youth. So, don't worry about all of our failures for the next 2 hours. You're going to have food and you're going to have great music.
The elections may also help boost the main opposition, the Democratic Alliance. Some polls of registered voters say the party could increase its share of the vote from roughly 17% to 23%. Siliers says there are some factors working in the DA's favor. He says urban dissatisfaction may lead some voters to split their vote for the provincial and national leadership. Helping the DA in a close race are parties to the left of the ANC, like the Economic Freedom Fighters, headed by the charismatic former leader of the ANC Youth League, Julius Malema. His party could take votes away from the ANC, as could a campaign by some party supporters. They are asking voters to protest against the ANC by choosing an alternative party or by casting a no vote or blank ballot. The Democratic Alliance already controls one of the country's 9 provinces, the Western Cape, and some, including analyst Hussein Solomon, say it could win the richest, Gauteng, or at least the commercial capital there, Johannesburg.
Gauteng is going to be a very close race, according to all the recent polls, between the ANC and the Democratic Alliance. And to complicate matters further, the ANC leadership of Gauteng, which is the richest province, I think about half of the GDP of South Africa comes from there, is a person called Paul Mashatile. He was actually opposed to Zuma's candidacy as president of the ANC and was actually campaigning against him. So there's all kinds of tensions inside the ANC there.
Siliers does not think this election is a turning point. It's hard to beat the ANC brand, he says. But future polls, including municipal elections, will be another opportunity for opposition parties to expand their influence. If that's the case, he says, the question is whether the ANC will continue to accept the wins and losses that come with a democracy, or whether party leaders believe they've earned the right to rule at any cost. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
China's prime minister is emphasizing his nation's commitment to investing in Africa during a visit to the continent. Martha van der Wolf reports from the African Union headquarters, where the Chinese premier delivered a policy speech.
Prime Minister Li Keqiang spoke Monday on China-Africa relations at the AU headquarters building, which was financed by China as a gift to the continent. China's policy towards Africa will focus in the next year on industrial cooperation, financial cooperation, poverty reduction, environmental protection, cooperation on cultural exchanges, and supporting peace and stability on the African continent. Prime Minister Li says he wants to expand trade between Africa and China. He says China and Africa should strive to reach $400 billion in annual trade and $100 billion of Chinese direct investment in Africa by 2020. He says China will take an active part in the industrialization in Africa. It is the first visit of Prime Minister Li to the African continent since he assumed office last year. China's trade with Africa totaled $210 billion in the past year. It is estimated China has also given more than $75 billion in the past decade for aid and development projects. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is also traveling in Africa. While the U.S. State Department is focusing much more on peace and stability, the Chinese visit is focused on strengthening trade cooperation. Mr. Li says trading with China comes with no political strings attached. He says that neither side seeks to impose its will on the other or interfere in the other's internal affairs. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Li will meet Ethiopia's President Mulatu Teshoma. After visiting Ethiopia and the African Union, Mr. Li will visit Kenya, Nigeria and Angola. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
22 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. President Obama welcomed Djibouti's President Ismail Omar Guelleh to the White House today. In a joint statement issued following the meeting, President Obama gave strong support for Djibouti's government's efforts to achieve its reform goals and to respond to the needs of its citizens. While President Guelleh highlighted the positive impact of U.S. investments in Djiboutian communities, particularly in the areas of health and education. The statement said the two leaders discussed their shared commitment to increased security and stability in the Horn of Africa and to prevent al-Qaeda and al-Shabaab from gaining new footholds. The two leaders pledged to continue to work to strengthen their strategic partnership.
Libyan officials today confirmed Ahmed Maitik as the nation's new prime minister after a stormy vote in parliament, opponents say, was not legal. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Ahmed Maitik is Libya's fifth prime minister in the 2.5 years since autocrat Muammar Gaddafi was ousted. A government decree Monday, signed by the acting Speaker of Parliament, confirmed the selection of the London-educated businessman after a controversial ballot in the Assembly the day before. Maitik failed to get the required votes in a turbulent session Sunday before the session was adjourned. He was later said to have gained the necessary votes, including from Islamist supporters, despite the earlier departure of many lawmakers. Parliament member Fatima Majbari called the vote a major violation of the law. She compared it to the irregularities surrounding the last vote of confidence in a previous prime minister, Ali Zidane. Zidane, who was briefly kidnapped last year, is reported to have fled the country. His successor, Abdullah Athini, resigned 3 weeks ago after security threats to him and his family. The whereabouts of the parliament speaker, whose signature is on the decree approving Maitik, is unclear. Libya has failed to unite in the post-Gaddafi period, divided by regional loyalties, countless militias, and an increase in terrorist groups. The U.S. State Department last week renewed its classification of Libya as a terrorist safe haven. The U.S. had a key role in a coalition that helped oust Gaddafi in 2011. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
The World Health Organization has declared the spread of polio an international public health emergency. The WHO is imposing a series of travel restrictions on countries infected with polio to stop the virus from spreading around the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Polio is endemic in three countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. But this crippling disease recently has re-emerged in seven countries in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, which had been polio-free. They are Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Ethiopia, Iraq, Israel, Somalia, and Syria. A WHO emergency committee considers the international spread of polio this year to be an extraordinary event. It warns the exportation of the wild virus poses a public health risk and must be stopped urgently. WHO Assistant Director General Bruce Aylward says the situation is particularly serious because the new polio infections have occurred between January and April, which is the low transmission season for the disease.
The committee highlighted to the Director General that if the situation as of today and April 2014 went unchecked, it could result in failure to eradicate globally one of the world's most serious vaccine-preventable diseases.
When WHO began its global polio eradication campaign in 1988, there were 350,000 cases of polio. Last year, there were 417 cases. So far this year, WHO reports 74 new cases, including 59 from Pakistan alone. Dr. Aylward cites Pakistan, Cameroon, and Syria as posing the greatest risk of further wild polio virus exportations in 2014. To prevent this from happening, the committee has come up with a series of recommendations. These include a demand that all residents and long-term visitors in affected countries get immunized against polio, either with an oral or inactivated poliovirus vaccine. This should be done between 4 weeks and 12 months prior to international travel. It also advises people traveling abroad from these countries to carry a certificate to prove they have been vaccinated against polio. Dr. Aylward says a coordinated international response is essential to stop the international spread of this crippling disease and to prevent more cases from emerging during the high transmission season in May and June.
The committee also highlighted that the consequences of further international spread are particularly acute today, given the large number of polio-free but conflict-torn and fragile states which have severely compromised routine immunization services and are at particularly high risk of infection. It highlighted as well that these states would have extreme difficulty in mounting an effective response should they become reinfected.
A case in point is Syria, which was polio-free for 14 years and has become reinfected from Pakistan. Aid agencies have mounted polio immunization campaigns inside this war-torn country with difficulty. However, they regularly immunize refugee children against the disease once they cross borders into neighboring countries. The WHO committee will reconvene in 3 months to reassess the situation. If their recommendations are not having the desired effect, health officials say there are other, more stringent measures that can be taken to try to stop the further spread of the polio virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
VOA Podcasts
are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOAAfrica.com.
Visit VOAAfrica.com and subscribe to our podcast service.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan's army battled rebels in Bentiu today, damaging hopes of new peace talks. The radical sect Boko Haram claims responsibility for last month's kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls in northern Nigeria. And China's prime minister emphasizes his nation's commitment to investing in Africa. Coming up, we'll have some music from Sierra Leone and in our feature segment, African Women in Politics. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young today. Happy Monday, Douglas.
Thank you, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we kick off with soccer.
Okay.
Yes, Liverpool striker Luis Suarez has been named Player of the Year by the Football Writers Association. The 27-year-old Uruguayan has scored 30 Premier League goals for a team chasing their first title since 1990. Suarez took 52% of the vote, with teammate Steven Gerrard second and Manchester City's Yaya Toure in third. Suarez, also named Player of the Year by the Professional Footballers Association, will receive his award at a dinner in London on May 15th. More than 300 journalists cast votes for the 10 nominees for the award, which was first won by Blackpool's Stanley Matthews in 1948. On Sunday, Liverpool manager Brendan Rodgers described Suarez as outstanding. Suarez's tally of 30 goals has come despite the fact that he missed the first 6 matches of the season as he completed a 10-match domestic ban for biting Chelsea defender Blažen Ivanović during a league match at Anfield in April 2013. The former Ajax striker's Liverpool future was in doubt last summer, as he indicated in May that it would be difficult to say no to Real Madrid, then told journalists in August that he wanted a move so that he could play in the Champions League. However, he signed a new 4.5-year contract with Liverpool in December. And in African football, the Confederation of African Football Executive Committee has suspended the Gambia Football Association from all CAF competitions for 2 years for deliberately falsifying players' ages. Last month, the Gambia were disqualified from the qualifiers for the continent's Under-20 Championship for fielding overage players. Now, the Gambia have been banned from all CAF competitions, including the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, in line with the clause in CAF's regulations. On April 20th, the Gambia was disqualified from the African Under-20 Championships for fielding 5 overage players in their qualifier against Liberia on April 6th. All 5 players were born in 1994, whilst the rules state that the competition is open to players born on or after January 1st, 1995. CAF then launched an investigation into the case of one of those players, Ali Sowe, born in June 1994. He was found to have registered with CAF in 2012 in the CAF Cup with an identical passport number but a birth date going back to 1988. The Gambia's disqualification means that Seychelles automatically go through to the second qualifying round for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. Seychelles will meet the winners of the tie between Swaziland and Sierra Leone for the right to join Cameroon, DR Congo, and Ivory Coast in Group D of the qualifying group phase. Gambia clubs will also be banned from playing in CAF's continental competitions for 2 years.
Visit VOA's website at www.voanews.com. You can read in-depth reports from VOA correspondents around the world. You can also download audio and video files and play them on your computer or portable MP3 player. www.voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is the Sunny Side of Sports coming to you live from Washington. Now let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Nightline Africa's sports reporter, Segun on the dot at DMA for more sports news. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas. The 2022 Commonwealth Games may be a long time away, but the competition has been generating controversy. Two cities, Durban in South Africa and Edmonton in Canada, are bidding to host the Games, a multi-sport event involving athletes from the Commonwealth of Nations. The host of the 22nd edition of the four yearly Games will not be announced until September 2, 2015. But a former president of the Athletic Federation of Nigeria, Dan Ngerem, has said Nigeria should not see the bid by South Africa to host the Games as the African bid. He says Nigeria's support for South Africa must be based on what Nigeria can benefit from such support.
I would have loved to say this is fantastic because I would have loved to characterize it as an African bid for the Commonwealth Games so that it can come to our shores for the very first time. But you see, they say those who must come to everything must come with clean hands. I don't think South African hands have been clean in terms of their relationship with Africa, particularly Nigeria. You know, we bidded for Commonwealth Games, if you remember, a few years ago in Colombo. We did not get optimal support from most South African countries, and South Africa in particular. So it appears that our bid was booby-trapped, as it were, because South Africa was hoping to bid and forget about bidding for Commonwealth Games. What South Africa is really interested in is the Olympic Games, because they've successfully hosted the World Cup in 2010. The fundamental question to ask now is, what did Nigeria benefit in the 2010 World Cup? If you tell me to hazard a guess, we benefited nothing. And if you look at the historical antecedent of South Africa and Nigeria, this country has practically spilled blood to make South Africa what it is today. Thabo Mbeki used to live here, in fact, the other street near this Lagos Motor Boat Club. Most South African companies are making mega billions in Nigeria. I can't see in the horizon remotely any Nigerian company that is doing anything significant in South Africa. So I've taken a long, circuitous route to come to my answer so that I can put things on a balance of equity. I haven't seen value added from South Africa. It cannot be a one-way traffic. So Nigeria must begin to demand and ask for commensurate support for our support on the continental level. It's a simple diplomacy, simple international relations.
You've been listening to Dan Ngerem, a former president of the Athletic Federation of Nigeria, speaking on why Nigeria must not give a blind support to South Africa in its bid to become the first African nation to host the Commonwealth Games in 2022. Many thanks to reporter Tony Atkins for that interview. The 2014 Commonwealth Games will be held in Glasgow, Scotland, while the Gold Coast in Australia will host the 2018 edition. Now, how much importance should be attached to the story of the banana-eating footballer Dani Alves? Not much, if you ask Brazil legend Pelé. Pelé says the outrage at the throwing of a banana toward compatriot and Barcelona defender Dani Alves was a social media storm in a teacup. Alves ate the banana thrown on the pitch near him during a match at Villarreal, Spain, and the host club banned the fan who threw the banana for life. Right after, the Twitter space buzzed with acclaim for the player's cool reaction to what is considered a terrible act of racism. But Pelé on Friday said the incident had been blown out of proportion. It is not just in football where there is racism. It's been around in all sectors of society for a long time, Pelé says. Barcelona and Brazil star Neymar was one of those who praised Alves after launching an anti-racist campaign on social media with the hashtag "We're all monkeys." Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff likewise hailed Alves' reaction. But Pelé insisted, "I do not agree there is a wave of racism. In my day, people threw guanabana fruits and mangoes at players." In more football news, legendary Moroccan goalkeeper and former African Footballer of the Year Badou Zaki has been named the coach of the country's national team, known as Atlas Lions, for a second time. The 55-year-old Zaki replaces interim coach Hassan Benabicha. The new coach will take charge of the Lions through the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations to be hosted by the North African country. Zaki also played for the Atlas Lions, featuring in many Africa Cup of Nations, as well as the World Cup. He previously coached the Moroccan national team between 2002 and 2006. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Umpuga in Washington.
Thanks, Segun. Now in Johannesburg, South Africa's Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma begins his report with the results of the Hamburg Marathon.
Ethiopian Shumi Dekchasa ran a lifetime best of 2 hours, 6 minutes and 44 seconds to win the Hamburg Marathon in Germany on Sunday. Kenya's Georgina Rono clocked 2 hours, 26 minutes and 48 seconds to win the women's contest. Elsewhere, Nigerian Blessing Okagbare won the women's 100 meters in 11.19 seconds at the IAAF World Challenge meet in Kingston, Jamaica on Saturday. In rugby, Kenya lost to England 26-5 in the plate final at the IRB Sevens tournament in Glasgow, Scotland on Sunday. Earlier on, Kenya dismissed South Africa 14-7 in the semi-finals. After the eighth leg in the series, South Africa are second with 139 points. Kenya is seventh with 72 points, while Zimbabwe is 18th with 1 point. In Somalia, 25 Somalis graduated with a football coaching license grade C in the capital Mogadishu. The Somali Football Federation technical director, Awil Ismail Mohammed, says this is the first international coaching course ever conducted in Somalia since independence in 1969. The course was conducted by experts from the World Football Governing Body, FIFA, and the Confederation of African Football. Finally, in golf, South Africa scored 873 points to win the All-Africa Junior Golf Challenge in Lusaka, Zambia. Zimbabwe is second ahead of Zambia. Reunion is fourth, followed by Uganda, Kenya, Tunisia, Namibia, Botswana, Mauritius, and Malawi.
Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks, Mark. American sprinter Tyson Gay received a one-year suspension on Friday after testing positive for a banned anabolic steroid in 2013. All his results from July 2012 onwards have been annulled, and he has already returned his relay silver medal to the U.S. Olympic Committee. The IOC will now have the final say on whether Tyson Gay's 4x100m relay teammates will be stripped of their London Games medals as well. That's according to Reuters news agency. Still, it's still unknown whether his teammates, Trail Kimmons, Justin Gatlin and Ryan Bailey, will also lose their Olympic silver medals they won in London in 2012. Athletics competitions must follow rules of the IAAF in the Olympics, but the IOC has the final say on matters including medals. Gay was banned by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, subject to appeal by the IAAF or the World Anti-Doping Agency. Gay, the joint second fastest man of all time, could have been suspended for 2 years for his first doping offense, but received a shorter ban because of his substantial assistance in the investigations of his case. The American 100 meters record holder is eligible to race again beginning June 23rd, and Reuters has learned he is making plans to return to competition in July. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Sunny Young will be back tomorrow. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, African women in leadership roles. And next, drones, the new technology to fight poaching in Kenya. But first, some music. Here is Sierra Leone's Alonzo with My Music.
through my music. And now I find love with my music. When situations bothers me, I listen to my music. And if I got a problem, I solve it with my music. Hey, man, I respect my music. Because I make money with my music. I am funny with my music. Cause I travel around the world cause of music. And you can take away my money, take away my car. But you can take away my music. You can take my girl in my house. But not my music. My music, my music. I got love for my music. I find peace in my music. My music, my music. Hey, I'm hopeful with my music. My music, hey, hey. I'm so blessed with my music. I'm internationally known for my music. Cause I spread the message with my music. Some people hate me for my music. They say I'm too hot with my music. But it can't stop my music. Because I got Christ in my music. There's so much power in music. That's why I'm helpless without my music. But Mali preach with music. And Fela Kuti die for music. Man, I'ma fight for my music. Cause it can shine through music. It's the only friend that I know. Music is the only thing I own. The only way I can express myself is through my music. My music, my music. I got love for my music. My music, my music. Because I find peace in my music. My music, my music. Hey, I'm hopeful with my music. My music, hey, hey, hey. I'm so blessed with my music. Music is the key to my soul. And music is the only friend I know. The only thing that makes me happy. Nah, ain't no more, they make ya de gladi. Cause there's no life without music. A music, hey. And there's no love without music. A music. Ain't no peace, no hope, no joy without music. A music. And there's no party without music. A music. You cannot find a single DJ without music. A music. No Grammy, no MTV without music. A music. Hey, I say I love you, my music. My music, my music. I got a love for my music. My music, hey, music. Because I find peace in my music. My music, my music. Hey, I'm hopeful with my music.
You know, music is the food to my soul.
Sierra Leone's Alonzo with My Music.
Well, Africa has three female heads of state since Catherine Samba-Panza took office in the Central African Republic in January. Though women leaders remain the exception in African politics, activists say things are looking up. Women are breaking into the boys' club of the African presidency. And look, files from Dakar.
Women are breaking into the boys' club of the African presidency. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, or Ma Ellen, was the first in 2005, as the country emerged from 13 years of brutal civil war. Joyce Banda stepped up in Malawi in 2012 after the sudden death of the president. She had been the vice president. And now there's President Catherine Samba-Panza in the Central African Republic, a country torn apart by rebellion and sectarian violence. Countries like Mali have seen their first female presidential candidates. Bad times are finally prying the doors open.
There was a joke that I read the other day that, well, I think when everything gets messed up, the women are asked to come in and clean up.
Executive director for the NGO Women Africa Solidarity, Oli Dibawada, says girls and young women are getting much-needed role models.
To come out and say, you know, it is possible. I can actually be a president being a woman. These trailblazers have, actually open the flood doors, and it's just going to happen. I don't think there is no thinking of going back. We can't go back.
As African women break political glass ceilings at all levels of government, some are criticized for not doing enough for other women. Mrs. Samba Panza made it clear from day one that she would be different. About a third of her cabinet is female.
I intend to respect parity because until now, the previous governments didn't give us a lot of seats. There were only two or three women, but I won't choose women no matter what. I need to have women of worth who are capable to accompany my actions.
Women hold just one-fifth of parliamentary seats and ministerial positions in sub-Saharan Africa. Discrimination remains, but the pool of qualified women is growing as more girls get to stay in school. At least 16 African countries have passed parity laws. Countries like Rwanda reserve a percentage of parliamentary seats for women, while others like Senegal have set quotas for women on candidate lists. The percentage of women in Senegal's legislature doubled in 2012, thanks to the law. But prominent Senegalese politician and presidential advisor Penda Mbo says true equality requires societal change.
Parity laws may be one tool, but they are not enough. We also need to fix what goes on inside political parties and let capable, promising women emerge naturally so that when they are promoted, no one can say they got special treatment.
Africa now has three formidable female presidents, tackling everything from security to corruption. Half a century after independence, women's time may have come. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
Drones will soon be watching over elephants and rhinos in Kenya's Olafajeta Conservancy. The small unmanned airplanes are the new technology to fight poaching in Kenya. A U.S. manufacturer has built a specially designed aircraft for poaching. Richard Vine, chief executive officer for the conservancy, tells Ricky Shryock he hopes the drone will help fight this trend once it is launched in June.
It's been through another development phase. We don't know whether that development phase is going to have taken it to the point that we can use it operationally or not. We hope that it will, in which case we'll put it into action as quickly as we can.
How will this drone work to fight poaching?
This is but one element in the fight against poaching. It's not going to be a silver bullet. The way we combat poaching is a variety of different ways, using different methods in a joined up, or hopefully a joined up sort of a way. So it depends upon good intelligence. It depends upon good community relationships. It depends upon an armed deterrent with high quality people operational on the ground. Exactly how we use it, we're not quite sure until such time as it's here and we're able to experiment with it, but it will be used probably primarily as a deterrent. If we know that there is a notorious poacher living in a house somewhere, there would be nothing to stop us flying the drone at night over his house to basically tell him that we know he's there.
Even if his house isn't on the conservancy?
Yeah, within limits, obviously. Probably more importantly, what it will be is just another tool in our armory to create a perception amongst those who wish to poach rhinos and or elephants that we have this at our disposal.
It's a surveillance drone, correct?
Absolutely, it's surveillance. And then it basically flies itself using an autopilot system, and it's equipped with very powerful cameras, including an infrared camera, which can operate to see things, or at least hot bodies, such as humans, at night.
Why was it seen that this kind of a step needed to be taken? Has poaching increased in recent years?
Let's talk about Africa as a whole. Poaching for rhinos and elephants across Africa has become much more serious over the past 3, possibly 4 years. That's in response to increasing demand from the Far East, particularly China and also Vietnam, for ivory and rhino horn. But anyway, as a result of all of that demand, the price payable now for those two commodities has increased very dramatically. So for example, now rhino horn is worth on the open market in places such as Vietnam, something in the region of $60,000 to $70,000 per kilogram. In Africa as a whole, I would say that the elephant poaching crisis is probably the worst it's been for certainly 20 years, and that's been quite well publicized.
That's Richard Vine, Chief Executive Officer for the Conservancy. He was talking to reporter Ricky Shryock. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the forefront of the United States foreign policy is the notion that America helps itself by helping others. U.S. Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs Tom Kelly said to the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in explaining how the U.S. Departments of State and Defense work together. The challenges we face today typically can't be solved by just our military or our economic engagement, and we can't resolve anything just with our diplomatic efforts either. Addressing the world's toughest problems really does take a whole-of-government effort, he said. Security cooperation is playing a central role in American foreign policy. Security is often the foundation for economic growth, democratic governance, and the preservation of human rights, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Kelly said. By helping our partners to take on greater security responsibilities, our assistance helps empower others to advance peace and stability, while at the same time reducing the likelihood of putting our military forces in harm's way. The rebalance towards Asia is a central U.S. policy based on the vision that America has an important stake in a prosperous and stable Asia-Pacific. All countries benefit from a global environment that is stable and prosperous, Mr. Kelly said. Reaching the goal of universal prosperity depends on security, in Asia-Pacific's case, maritime security. We know that you don't get to trade within Asia and with Asia and the Americas without open sea lanes. In Asia, as in the rest of the world, the key to effective security is effective security partnerships. The United States is working to modernize its alliance and ensure that we can cooperate seamlessly with partners to respond to crises and contingencies, Mr. Kelly said. The potential problems are not limited to those caused by people. Mother Nature sometimes forcefully reminds us that she is in charge. By tackling the world's toughest problems together, we can bring new perspectives and expanded capabilities to bear, Mr. Kelly said in conclusion. We can build partnerships to be proud of, within government, with civil society, and with nations around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.